would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to be me. Then you'd see and agree that every man should be free.
Welcome to Voices from the Front Lines, your national movement building show. Wake up and smell the revolution. Today, I'm really happy to be with such an important friend, even though we've never directly met. That's how I feel about you, Ron. Ron Kovic, just such a tremendously courageous anti-war organizer. That's the main way, also a great author. I think most of you know the book Born on the 4th of July. He's also done a book called Hurricane Street. But today we're going to talk about the book that I just read. Pretty beautiful and pretty tough book to read, and I'm sure it was a tough book to write. It's called A Dangerous Country, An American Elegy. It's produced by Akashic Books. They did a real nice job with it, by the way. It's a very attractive hardcover. Ron, so much to talk about. I mean, why don't you start with that you use the letters. This is the first time you've published your letters from Vietnam, and here you were, a 21-year-old kid, you know, a young man.
You mean the diary?
Yes, I'm sorry, the diary.
Diary, right, yes.
I'm sorry, the diary to yourself, right.
You know, I held on to that diary for years. I was very hesitant to share it with anyone. I thought of publishing it by itself, but I thought that would not be the message that I want to send out. I want to tell the whole story. And I had thought of doing this book, A Dangerous Country, An American Elegy, you know, for several years. I wrote Hurricane Street, but in the back of my mind, I wanted to do this, and I just hoped that I lived long enough to be able to write this book. This is the last book of the Vietnam trilogy for a reason, because it was by far the most naked, vulnerable. It was the most difficult book to write. It was a confession, in a sense, to America. It was a revealing of myself. I think important literature is literature that is truthful and honest to the point of exposing yourself at risk. And I can think of there was a Nobel Peace Prize writer, a playwright. I met him in London during a Quaker conference, and I'm trying to think of his name. It was only a few years ago. He's since passed away, but he talked about what was really important in regard to what literature should be. And he was talking about risking, being willing to risk, being willing to be as honest to the point of being vulnerable, putting yourself out there, and to be attacked even, but to tell the truth, to explain war for what it really was, physically, psychologically, emotionally, so people would begin to realize we have to find an alternative to this way of behaving. We have to find an alternative to this type of barbaric pulling of triggers, dropping of bombs. There's got to be another way. And we're creative, we're innovative, we're intelligent human beings, and we can, I believe, absolutely, we can find an alternative, whether it's in Gaza or whether it's in Ukraine right now, wherever it might be, that as human beings, we have to find a way through this, and we can, and we try.
You know, we would add South Central Los Angeles, where we are, and where the police pull the trigger every day on Black children and Black adults. Starting with your diary, it was very vulnerable to talk about that young man who was you, who just loved America, loved his commanding officers, loved everything. He was just loving God, loving the United States.
Absolutely.
and such a good kid in a certain way. You know what I mean? How'd you feel about reading that and saying, hey, wait a minute, that was me?
Well, you know, I pick up the book now and I read through it occasionally. It really moves me. It moves me really, it moves me deeply. To go back to that boy, I know who that boy was. I think I'll always, in a way, have that boy inside of me. But so much has changed since then. It was the innocence of America at that particular time. It was not just me, but I think, in a way, collectively speaking, it represented, in a sense, the soul of this country, the collective mind of this country, where they were at, a certain innocence after World War II, the baby boom generation. What does it feel like reading the... I'm happy that I can publish this. I'm happy that I can share my honesty, my innocence, my love of this country. But all that was to change. As I wrote in the introduction, all that was to be shattered in Vietnam, and it was shattered. My belief system, my belief in God, my belief in my country, wanting to leave this country for years, wanting to expatriate to another country, wanting to find some other place in America, which I felt that had really led me down the wrong path. But initially, I felt we were doing the right thing. And I think that the diary in the beginning of this book, A Dangerous Country, is very important. I think it represents not only my innocence, but again, the innocence of the country during that period. Do you agree with that or what?
No, because at the same time that you were there, I was at the SDS March on Washington. And I was a field secretary with the Congress of Racial mm-hmm. Equality. And that was the most transformative day of my life, because I'd already been in the Black movement. I'm a Jew from Brooklyn, and I've been in the Black community since I'm maybe 16. And the speeches that day, Paul Potter talked about what kind of system would create the atrocities in Vietnam. We have to name that system. And then Bob Moses said, we have to make the connection between defoliation in Vietnam and segregation in Mississippi. I.F. Stone said, don't trust the government. They lied about Korea. They lied about Vietnam. And then Staunton Lynn said, you have to put your body on the line. He talked about, I don't want to say because I may get the name wrong, but the brother who set himself on fire back then. Mm-hmm. And I was already a revolutionary, but I was transformed. But the thing we did well, Ron, is when we would meet you at the stage you were in, we approached you with love. Contrary to the stereotype, we would say, hey, brother, this is the wrong war. You don't want to go there. We never, ever, this is the lies that we never talked about the GIs in any way but a good way. We said, this is not the right war. You're going to go over there. You're going to have a bad experience. We did draft resistance. Just so that the soldiers would begin to know, what am I getting into here? So I think that some of us had innocence. Other of us had already the growing horror of what this country really is. But I think the positive about your book, and of course who you became, is we love the boy who was in his diary. I could have talked to him.
I agree.
I would not have in any way. I would have listened and talked to him and said, yes. I get it. I get it. I just don't see it that way, but check it out.
And so, I was to join you and be influenced by you and by Professor Zinn and others. It would take me time, not right away. It would take incidents that happened that I wrote about in that diary.
Yes, absolutely.
That shocked me, that stunned me. It would take the overcrowded conditions in the Bronx VA, the rats on the ward. It would take me witnessing Kent State University and the shooting down of the student by the National Guard. And slowly but surely, not overnight, not suddenly, did not grow up that way. I grew up with a flag and with 4th of July and that, but I made a profound change. Yes, it was the loss of 3/4 of my body being wounded so severely. It was the trauma. It was killing other human beings. I mean, the nightmares, the anxiety attacks, all of this led me to, it's not easy. You know better than I do. It's not easy to change. And you have to be shocked in order to even make the most incremental change sometimes. But I was shocked. I was stunned psychologically, physically, and that began to move me toward opening myself to you, to Dr. Zinn, to even Abby Hoffman, to Jerry Rubin, and to many others. Reading Do It, reading Revolution for the Hell of It, just being involved, being thrown in jail, as you spent many years, what was it, year and a half in jail?
Right.
Yeah, and I have tremendous respect for that. That was heroic, and probably extremely difficult and painful. Who recognizes your sacrifice? You know, who talks about what you and others who suffered during that period went through, you know? So they honor the veterans, they honor their sacrifice. But who talks about those other heroes who stood up against the war, you know, who risked their, not only their lives, but, you know, risked their names. And so, I mean, it, you know.
That means a lot, Ron, that means a lot what you said. You know, when I got into prison, there's a story where I walked into prison and three guys came up to me and said, hey, we decided to become communists. I said, why? They said, well, the guards kept telling us, this guy's coming. You don't want him. You don't like him. He's a communist. And we were thinking, well, we don't like communists, but why are the guards so adamant we're not supposed to like you?
Right.
So we started studying about communism because they told us not to. And by the time you got here, we said, anybody who scares the guards enough that they're trying to organize us, before you got here, but they said, you're the only one in here for doing something good, which was really nice. You know, you're the only one. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very sweet what you said. In your book, you do a really great job of the step-by-step consciousness-raising process of yourself. And I work closely with Howard Zinn, which is another story. But I read this book, and then I saw this, and then I was beginning to change, and then maybe you can reconstruct a little bit from the book in your own memory, step by step, the light bulb's going off.
Oh, yeah, I can, you know, well, being in the hospital, being in the intensive care ward in Da Nang, seeing the most severely wounded, in Born on the 4th of July, I write about the black pilot dying next to me. I can remember at a certain point, when I left the VA hospital, and I used a GI Bill to go to Hofstra University on Long Island,
right.
And I remember there were several books that began to awaken me. One was on, I had already mentioned Do It and Revolution for the Hell of It, but I remember reading later on reading books, The State and Revolution by Lenin. I remember reading. Wanting to know that being, yes, giving speeches and going on television shows and by being attacked for being a communist, actually called a communist. And I said, wait a second, I just gave my life for this country and you're calling me a communist. Wait, they sent us to fight the communists. What are you talking about? And so what is this thing? You know, and so I wanted to know and I wanted to understand. What was this name all about that they were calling me, you know? So I read books about it. I you know, what else? Well, People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn, you know, which really awakened me to an authentic, true, honest, sincere history of the United States, not the myth and not the lies. And, you know, I wondered what kind of education did I receive growing up in Massapequa, in my hometown, you know? You know, you talked about your position. I mean, those around you and what influenced you. And I never experienced that. I experienced the Cub Scouts, the Boy Scouts, the Little League. I my father and mother served after the day after December 7th, 1941. My father joined the Navy, and not long after that, my mother, who was from Brooklyn, my father was grew up on a farm in northern Wisconsin. My mother joined the Waves, the Navy, and they met. They were serving in Washington, D.C., and they met and they were married. So I grew up with parents who both served during World War II. And I mean, what did I read? What kind of books did I read in high school? Red Badge of Courage by Stephen Crane. Did that teach me? Was that Dalton Trumbo's Johnny Got His Gun? No. When I read Johnny Got His Gun, that was a shocker. That was profound. And I met Trumbo when he was still alive in the early 70s in L.A., and I had the honor of actually shaking his hand. And I was able to tell him, your book, Joe Bonham, the character, I identified with Joe Bonham. I identified with this man trying, striving to be heard, wanting to tell people what the war was really all about, the wrongness of it, the absurdity and the idiocy of the war. I couldn't tell enough people. I couldn't speak to enough people. And every time, the closer I got to telling people what was going on, they either pulled the plug at a demonstration on one of my mics, which they did once, or they called me these names. They called me a radical. They called me a communist for simply trying to speak the truth about what had happened in that war. They didn't want to hear the truth. And so I did. I was affected by Johnny Got His Gun. I had quite a few books that profoundly influenced me.
You know, Ron, one of the things about the reason I love your book is because I love books. You know, we have a bookstore here, the Strategy and Soul Bookstore, and we're going to have your book in it. We're going to order your books for the bookstore, which is in South Central Los Angeles. And I always talk to people about what was the book, the film, the conversation that first shook you up, changed your worldview. You know, I've written about 7 books. I'm working on a book now called We Made the Revolution with Our Bodies on the Line. I'm 81 and I'm in good shape, but I'm still, please, I got to finish this damn book. And my wife, Leanne, is helping me. And we have a July 31st deadline to finish. Yeah. But I know what it's like about your own mortality.
Yeah.
And this book is really, really good. I mean, it's unusually good because I wanted to say this carefully, but you already said it. Perhaps you could discuss what you went through, because this is about consciousness raising. I want to tell you a good story, actually. I was in Newark, and in the Black community again, and some guy came up to me and said, we want to do draft resistance to get Black people not to fight in Vietnam. I said, well, I don't know anything about it. They said, well, don't worry. You can walk into a draft board. Nobody's ever trying to keep you out of one. So I went into the draft board and we're waiting to raise our hands. And I said, wait, I'm not going to Vietnam. This is an imperialist war. This is a racist war. Nobody should fight in Vietnam. I'm getting out of here. I walked out. But then this Black brother comes after me and says, me too. I went, oh my God, I had no idea. Wait, I wasn't drafted. He says, I don't care. What are we going to do now? I had never thought of it. So I called Lenny Wineglass, who was
Lenny.
Good friend. Of course.
I remember Lenny.
I know.
Lenny
of course
well.
You do. Of course you do. So I called Lenny Wineglass and said, Lenny, what the hell do I do now? He said, come on over. We'll figure it out. And we kept that brother out of the war. And every time I saw Lenny, he said, that guy says, thank you. Thank you for saving my life. So what I'm getting to is books, films, experiences. Tell me the story of what you went through when you grasped you had killed someone. Because that's such a rough, I mean, you talk about honest and beautiful. The agony you described for years and years and years, maybe tell the listeners a little bit more about it.
Well, I was sent over to kill communists. I was sent over to fight the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese.
Right.
And I was, I was taking out patrols almost every night up in the DMZ. And I was a competent sergeant in charge of 11, 12 man scout team. And one night during a firefight, pretty fierce, I accidentally shot and killed one of my own men. It was beyond traumatic, beyond. I mean, I had trained to fight the enemy. I had been sent over to fight against the communists. And here, in the end, I kill one of my own men. It shocked me to my roots. It was devastating. I went back to my tent that night, back to my hooch, and I sat where the other men were asleep. I put my rifle to my forehead, my M14 rifle, and I remember taking my boot off and my putting my toe on the trigger. And I came very close to killing myself that night. But in the end, I decided I just backed away from it. I couldn't do it. And I lived with that night and the nightmare of that night, unable to talk about that night, so ashamed and so devastated and so shocked by what I had done, so embarrassed by what I had done. I mean, I tried to be the best Marine that I could be. As you see in the diary, I was striving to have
Yes.
the best scout team. I was striving to make the men the very best to win the war. That's I couldn't stand the protesters. They were burning the American flag in Sheep Meadow and in Central Park. And I said, I'm going to set my own example of patriotism. I'm going to show them, those protesters, I'm going to go back to Vietnam a second time, and we're going to win a victory just as our fathers in the neighborhood and our mothers had won the victory of World War II. We're going to do that. We're not going to lose this war. We're going to win. And I'm going to prove to everybody, I'm going to go back and show how we're going to win this war. And then to have that night happen, to have everything shattered. I mean, I, to this day, I mean, as long as I live, as long as I breathe, I mean, it will always haunt me, always be a part of me. And if I have any relief from what happened on that night in 1967, October, it is that I wrote, I wanted to write this. I wanted to tell this truth. I wanted people to know who didn't even know in the anti-war movement, who thought of me as a as an anti-war leader, an activist. I wanted them to know who I had been at one time. I never brought this person up, this young man, this 21-year-old in the diary. I never brought that up. I never brought up that night, that traumatic night, that night that I killed someone, a human being. I took a life out of this world, a life out of this world. I felt like I, for the longest time, a part of me felt that I needed to die. I felt that I had no right to live. And I lived with that. I lived that not only in those months that I continued to lead patrols. I decided not to quit. I decided to continue to fight and lead my men, but that was always with me, that terrible, terrible guilt and shame, shame for what I had done. And it affected me deeply, profoundly. It shook me to my roots. And as I said before, I might have said to you, it's not easy to make change. You know that it takes something that's shocking, and that was shocking. That over time, slowly but surely, the shame of what had happened, the terrible mistake that I made as a human being, as a young Marine, it shook me to my roots. I was never and would never, ever be the same again. It led me to those books. It led me to seeking alternatives. It led me to try to understand, is there something more to this? And what does it do? I mean, you take another life out of this world. I mean, there's no way to describe it other than I stopped a beating heart. You know, I took a life out of this world, regardless. Well, you protested the war. Do you make up for it? No. No. Can you ever make up for it? No. Can you ever forgive or be forgiven? I don't know. I don't know. I think there's a great attempt in the book to move through that, to face that trauma head on, head on. And if I leave anything behind in the time remaining, and I'm going to be 78, and just like you, I feel that I understand. I felt that mortality, that vulnerability, for years since I was 21. I felt life was short. I was driven, you know, not knowing how long I would live. And I still feel that way at my age. And I'm grateful, so grateful to be alive and still be breathing, to be able to be contributing. And I mean, I don't think that I one of the most important things to me, if I could show people what war does psychologically, physically, and I think I did that in A Dangerous Country, whether I was so, you know, psychologically tormented. The chapter in the psychiatric hospital describing, here I was a reporter in a sense, describing the other psychologically wounded, what war did to them physically, psychologically.
Ron, I mean, it's interesting because, first of all, the amazing voice you're hearing is Ron Kovic, and you're on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, streaming live on the web on kpfk.org. Check out our wonderful website, voicesfromthefrontlines.com, produced by Channing Martinez. Check out our podcast. Send us emails at Channing and Eric at voicesfromthefrontlines.com. And Ron, you know, so much to say. I mean,
could I just say one thing? Could I say one thing that
you can say too?
Yeah. In the end of all of that, what did I learn? That besides politics and besides all of these books, that life was precious. All life, all human beings have a right to live in this world, regardless of whatever ideology they may profess. I mean, we all are human beings. We have a right to live in this world and live together. And there's got to be an alternative to this type of approach to solving our problems, aggression, bombs, pulling triggers, killing human beings. We are intelligent. We are creative. We are innovative. And I believe we can make this world a more peaceful place, a better place. Let that be whatever my legacy, whatever you want to call it, but let that be that I represent not just the wounding, not in this chair. I don't represent just the wounding, the savagery of that war, but I represent the hope of a perhaps a more sane country, a more sane world, a more beautiful world. Let that be not just that here was somebody a victim of a war, but somebody who was able to have a vision of a better world, a better day, a more intelligent world, and a more caring and loving world.
Well, you're making that contribution, Ron, and that the book, A Dangerous Country, An American Elegy, is in some way, and you're on, again, with Ron Kovic and Eric Mann on Voices from the Frontlines. You know, most people don't want to live with the ambivalence of, they don't want to live with the ambivalence that you can be a good person and a bad person. You could be a good person who did bad things. How do you live with that? How do you live with loving yourself, which I'm still working on, and still seeing things? Most people don't want to see. In other words, in order to feel good, they don't want to see what they did. In your case, there are so many so-called extenuating, I mean, you were in a war, not of your choosing. You were a war because the United States and France were trying to dominate the world forever. You were there because after Dien Bien Phu, the miserable French finally got out and the Americans came in. Or that is, I was talking to a Vietnamese cab driver, Uber driver today. He said that, ironically, he said, you know, after the war, we thought they were all going to go away. We thought we could finally have our country. We had fought against the Japanese only to be told that the French are coming back in. So those were broader historical events far beyond your control. There shouldn't have been a war in Vietnam. And then within that, Ron, you've done everything humanly possible. Friendly fire, as they call it, is not unique in wars. People are shooting, they're scared, there are kids. As you said, you were 21, and a lot of people in your unit were 19. So they're kids with guns, and they're told by the system, go out and kill anything in your way. Well, you kill anything in your way. And of all tragedies, one of whom was a member of your own company. So your journey to forgive yourself is only because you're such a courageous person that you wanted to see what you did, that you were seeking forgiveness, which you deserve, by the way, not that I offer it, but you were seeking forgiveness because you were one of the few people that wanted to look in the mirror.
It was not easy, but, you know, ironically, I grew up a Catholic and I grew up with a strong faith, as you see in the diary. And in a way, you know, I thought in a way the book is a confessional in a way. Yes, I think you're right. Seeking forgiveness. a seeking faith and a different kind of faith than growing up a Catholic, but believing that there is something other than.
Something other than.
Don't know. It's a struggle. This book is about a journey from war, from trauma. It's a book about healing, a struggle to find faith again, a struggle to find some faith in my country, if not the false patriotism I might have been taught as a young man, but true and authentic patriotism, if there is such a thing. I mean, what would be wrong with loving a country if the country truly cared for its people and truly. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm shaking the computer here. But
You're fine. But you know, Ron, one of the things that could again give you some real hope to understand is that, I mean, the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, I've read, is it called The Winter Soldier Testimony?
sure.
The men that came back and what they were willing to say they did, you know what I mean? The risks they took and threw their medals back at the Congress and
Yeah.
but they did testimony, amazing testimony about what they ended up doing and what the war forced them to do, what the United States government forced them to do. So you were part of a whole movement of young, Vietnam veterans who came back and said, I don't want any part of this. You were part of the film, Sir, No, Sir. I mean, with all these amazing GIs who were in Okinawa and all over the world protesting against the war. You were part of the black GIs who were put into prison in, by their commanding officers. There's this thing in Sir, No, Sir, where these black soldiers protest and the army says, all right, if you drop the protest, we're going to look into this. They drop the protest and they put them all in solitary confinement. So I don't think that this country has a soul. I think the people have a soul. And I think we have to have a different country, a different society. A revolution means I don't want any part of this. I don't want to justify its history. I don't want to find good in it. I want something better that we can make, a new world that we can make. And the reason I wake up every morning, I walk in South Central Los Angeles. A young woman sitting under our awning says, please don't throw me out. She's houseless. And I said, honey, why would I throw you out? Here's a blanket, sleep under our awning. Of course you're welcome here. So I wake up in the morning with my deep ties to the people, in particular to the black community and to Tommy Smith and Juan Carlos, Don Carlos, and Muhammad Ali and Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and
Yeah.
Fannie Lou Hamer and all the people, the black people said, we don't want this war. We do not want this war. So I think you should, I know it's a funny thing, give yourself a little bit more credit because, I was in Valley Stream when you were in Massapequa, by the way, Ron. So,
Yeah. Valley Stream.
yeah. So the point I'm saying is you couldn't have done any better.
I try to do my best, but I try to. I had a lot of responsibility at 21. I had lives in my hands, and if you've never been there, then you don't understand what that means.
Right, that's right.
But that stays with you. These lives, you have a responsibility to protect every one of them to get them home, and when you don't do that, you feel like you failed. And no, listen, I'm grateful for this. I'm grateful for this journey that I've been on. I'm thankful for it. I'm grateful for every single day of my life. And I want the same world that you just described. That's exactly what I want. And I reject that brutality and that I know things can become better. I know things can change. I only hope, I hope and pray that they can change peacefully as Dr. King would want them to change, nonviolently, without violence, without killing, without this cycle of violence that King used to talk about. No, you know, that's the difference with me because of what I went through. No government will ever, again, as I said at the end of the book, will ever teach me to hate another human being. Nobody will ever point me to a country or to a people and tell me that they're my enemy. No. I was profoundly, as I said, changed by this. It's very difficult for me to even the thought of using violence to change this country, even to make these changes. This country was born in a revolution. You know, people were killed on both sides. People were maimed on both sides. We don't talk about that. We don't talk about perhaps British soldiers who might have come over here who were 19 and 21, similar to myself. They probably were. And they were shot. They were killed. Perhaps they were paralyzed. They came back home to England and they were psychologically shattered for life. No, we don't even think about those things. Don't talk about those things. Or what happens to our own young men who come back from these conflicts. You know, we're told that we are heroes. We're told that we're heroic. Even if we were never in combat, everybody's a hero. Everybody right. Who put on the uniform is a hero, you know, but it's not necessarily true, you know. I think we need to profoundly change our country and change this world, yeah. But how do we do it? How do we proceed? How do we move forward? Do we use violence? No, I don't think so. I can't. I would never. I can never agree with that. I can never go along with that type of leadership. No. To me, it's got to be changed through courage, through boldness, through creativity, through imagination, through a willingness to seek common ground and to, you know, anything other than ever pulling a trigger again, anything other than ever exploding a bomb. You know, it's got to be peacefully and nonviolently. So I stand with King on that. I stand with King, and I always will.
Well, Ron, let me ask you this. In your book, you also described your artwork and the ferocious you'd go on an acid trip where days at a time you wouldn't even, you were just painting from morning right. to night. Tell me about your artwork and what, you know, did that offer you, if not joy, release? And where do we find your artwork, too? I'm interested in seeing it.
Well, you know, ironically, my girlfriend came over earlier, and I was showing her a couple of paintings or pictures that I did. I was just beginning to put on the dining room table. I wanted to get these. I was telling her I want to get these on the internet. You know, one depicted Marines with helmets, seeming dazed, and everything below them, all the fragments of their lower parts, and then there were others of homeless veterans, 1997, San Francisco, California, a bunch of them standing in front of a homeless shelter, a black and white charcoal piece. And where can we, I would like to display them on the internet. I would like to share them with others. But, you know, art that makes a statement, art that tells, even simplistic art, art that's, would you call it people's art? Art that comes from average human beings who don't claim to be Renoir, don't claim to be Pollock, you know, who have to say something, who have to get something out of their heart and their soul, have to want to express something, and they do it as if the cavemen did, you know, scratching pictures on walls. You know, what does it matter whether you're recognized by the New York art critic? What does it matter? You know, as long as you make a statement, as long as you affect people's their consciousness and their hearts, you know, yeah. I mean, that was an important period for me because I was able to leave the writing about the war behind for a while. And I was always trying to write as honestly as possible. In a way, it was my redemption. In a way, it was, I was struggling to... struggling to come home, and the only way I could come home would be, moving to telling the truth, not going along with society wanting me to be the heroic, courageous veteran who had come back from the war. It was not enough for me, not after what I had seen, not after what I had done. I had to tell him a greater truth about what this policy did, what it did to me, what it did to my brothers and my sisters as well. Yeah.
Well, the voice you're hearing is Ron Kovic. The other voice is me, Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines, but an interesting concept. Voices from the Frontlines. You have a beautiful voice, Ron, and all the people in struggle have beautiful voices. That's the thing, that there's only the voice of conscience, the voice of somebody who matters in the world. You know, there are so many vacant voices out there that are so unattractive, and you're on KPFK, where important voices are heard. This is going to be Friday morning at 7 a.m., and you're going to listen to Ron and Eric, and Ron, we got to get your art up there somewhere, because when I was reading the book is called A Dangerous Country, an American Elegy. You did have an exhibition in New York of your books. I think there are all these people that are good at getting stuff on the internet. I wouldn't volunteer Channing Martinez because he's too talented getting all the stuff up for us. But I'm sure there's somebody who would work with you on that, because it's another part of your legacy. And I don't mean joyful in the superficial sense, but it is, in reading the section on the book, I think you were in Sausalito, and you were just painting like crazy.
Yeah, the chapter was called The Art of Healing.
Right, right. So obviously I've read your book, brother. I've read it carefully and slowly.
Yeah, I know you did.
You got to get this book, folks, A Dangerous Country, an American Elegy. You'll be able to get it at Strategy and Soul Books very soon at 3546 Martin Luther King Boulevard, in the most gorgeous South Central Los Angeles, at the corner of King and Crenshaw, which is like 125th and Lenox, or now 125th and Malcolm X. Ron, it's been a real pleasure. Some last thoughts. That's interesting. Really, you can pre-order it online at thestrategycenter.org. It says Channing Martinez, and we're going to get it for you. So you can pre-order it, and as soon as we get it, go to thestrategycenter.org. Go on there and find our bookstore. Pre-order Ron Kovic, A Dangerous Country. We're proud to have it. You know, Ron, in the bookstore, it's called a curated collection. I'm the bookstore curator, and you got to be really good to get in. You know, you got to be in with Black Reconstruction America with W.E.B. Du Bois, A Europe Underdeveloped Africa by Walter Rodney, The Open Veins of Latin America by Galeano, Playbook for Progressives by Eric Mann. We have great books in there, The Black Woman by Tony K. Bambara. So you're going to be in there. You got into one of the coolest bookstores by invitation only, brother.
Well, I'd be honored. And I want to thank you, and I want to recognize in front of your listeners your heroic contribution and the courage that it took for you to do what you did, and the fact that you never gave up, and you will never give up, and you will continue on until you do create that beautiful country and beautiful world that we'll all be able to celebrate, hopefully someday, and in the not too distant future, hopefully.
A lot, you know, Ron, deep in our hearts, we do believe that we shall overcome someday.
Yes.
So you're a pleasure, and you're really inspiring to me. When you're in LA, come on, we'll do a book signing for you.
I would love to.
All right, we're going to make it happen. Love to everybody, and your publicist did a great job, Holly Watson and Michelle Belitsky. They were on the case. They were on the case, and they kept calling me, and we made this happen. So, Ron, deep honor to be with you, brother, and we'll keep the conversation going.
Thank you. It's an honor to be with you. And we reached out to you because of your importance, because of your courage, because of the sacrifice that you made that hopefully people will never forget.
Well, you made my day, brother. I'll talk to you real soon.
All right, brother. Bye-bye now.
Take care.
Bye.
Take care.
Welcome back to Voices from the Front Lines. I'm Channing Martinez, your co-host of Voices from the Front Lines. The conversation you just heard was with Ron Kovic and Eric Mann. If you don't know, Ron Kovic is the author of A Dangerous Country, An American Elegy. And most famously, the book was just published in February, and it's part of this trilogy along with Born on a Fourth of July and Hurricane Street. As Eric Mann just mentioned to you in the interview, you can go to www.thestrategycenter.org right now to purchase the book if you're interested. And the conversation you're about to hear is about a film coming to Strategy. And so, but before I get to that, I have two things for you. Call right now, 818-985-5735 to continue to support movement-based radio conversations like this, where we get to really dig in deep around movement building and what we can learn today. And then number two, if you're a regular listener to Voices, you're probably wondering, what is this song in the background? If you haven't caught the drift, I love Afrobeats, and you can look this song up. It's called Ego Beta by Dele Sosimi, who's from Nigeria. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to Eric, who's going to talk about this great film coming to Strategy and Soul.
So thanks, Channing. You know, we run the Strategy and Soul bookstore at 3546 Martin Luther King Boulevard, King and Crenshaw. We run the Strategy and Soul Film Theater, 3546 Martin Luther King, right next to it. And one reason we do is because revolutions are primarily about ideas. Of course, they have to be translated into arms, into organization. But people fight for ideas. And that's one reason I'm worried about Donald Trump, because he has an idea, and I'm not sure what Joe Biden's idea is. So the reason this is relevant, because Donald Trump is a fascist, is this really fine film. It's called The Old Oak. Now, it's coming to the Strategy and Soul Film Theater on Thursday night, April 11th at 6 p.m. And you got to come. You got to come because my friend, Emily Russo, who's the head of Zeitgeist Films, we've been friends for a long, long time. And we met at the American Film Festival before she invented Zeitgeist and before I invented the Strategy Center. So we've been helping each other in the world ever since. So Zeitgeist is a terrific producer and distributor of very fine films. So Emily called me up and pulled my coat and said, hey, listen, I know you like Ken Loach, who a lot of you should know. I'll tell you about him. He's got this new film called The Old Oak. Do you want to run it at Strategy and Soul? And I said, hell yeah. And especially because it's opening the next Friday. In other words, Thursday the 11th will be with us. Friday the 12th, it opened at the Lemley. I think it's the Santa Monica. We'll get you the advice before. So it's cool that we like everybody to open on Thursday at Strategy and Soul and open in a commercial theater on Friday. And we're going to kind of try to go to both to support both. So All right, so let me tell you about the Old Oak. A lot of you know Ken Loach. I mean, he's a radical socialist, anti-war filmmaker. He's now 86. According to him, this will be his last film. This is his last film. I've seen a lot of his film, but The Wind That Shakes the Barley is the film about the Spanish Civil War that is so incredibly complex and terrific film. He won the Palme d'Or at Cannes for that. He also did one called I, David Blake, which is about a working class white guy, which is most of what his characters are, who's crushed by the decline of the social service system and the disintegration of any help. He's trying everywhere to get help. So this film, The Old Oak, is a bar. And it's a bar in a working class British area where it used to be a mining town. And so they had a union. They fought Thatcher. They worked in the mines. And mining is just an incredibly, besides that the coal is unbearable, the mines are unbearable, and how these miners have gone in for hundreds of years, and they're proud of it. They're really proud to go down into the mines, and they have a mine workers' union. So now the mines have shut down. So now the area is sort of like a ghost town. The Old Oak is the bar, but we're not clear what anybody's doing there. And most of the guys there, that is guys, are older white guys. So a lot of what the film's about to start with is that Tommy Joe Ballantyne, or TJ, is the head of the, is the bartender. He's played by a guy named Dave Turner, who was not an actor, who was just a working class guy, but is a phenomenal actor. So Dave Turner is kind of depressed, and the whole place is so depressing, and the role of alcohol, you know, I'll have another pint, I'll have another pint, in both the Irish films and the British films, I'll have another pint. But in every movie you see today, the smoking and drinking and the just drinking is so integral to the culture of a depressed culture that just people drink because it makes you feel good until it doesn't. So in here, there's no feeling good about this bar, and there's no feeling good about the people there. And all of a sudden, a group of Syrians are bust in, and one of the women, named Yara, played by Ebla Mahdi, is very charming woman, and some racist breaks her camera. So it starts out that TJ, just as a nice guy, says, well, actually, I have a bunch of old cameras that I can get out of the pawn shop and help you. The story is about their relationship. And the story is about, can you turn a racist town around? And there's nothing in looking at these guys that makes you think they can. Now, the article in the Variety said, Ken Loach's drama shines light on working class British racism until it succumbs to a soft-hearted wish fulfillment. Meaning that when you see the film, at first, it's not clear. It's there's a deep friendship between TJ and Yara. Very beautiful. But how in the hell is this whole town going to get turned around? Well, the end of the film, it does. And at first, when I was watching it, I was thinking, and yes, I watched it with Leanne Hurst, my partner and wife, and I thought, well, this is very unpersuasive how all of a sudden the town gets turned around. As an organizer, you know, I had one set of lenses about the film. But then I thought, so what? So what? What's the point? It's not wish fulfillment. It's trying to show you the possibility of an alternate image. We have enough white racists running around. I don't need to see another film about British white racists, American white racists, you know, French white racists. The film says that there's a humanity between two people, between a bartender and a Syrian refugee. And they become very deeply friends. He's going through a rough time in his life, and there's a phenomenal humanity. And if you're really a good organizer, you know what? At the end of the day, it is relationships. I mean, they're just certain people like each other, care about each other. And if that's the point, that a working class white guy and a Syrian refugee woman can find a common humanity and turn the city around, what's the criticism? What don't you like? I think it's a beautiful film, and you should come see it. So, come on, see it. You'll be able to get tickets by Monday. You can go on thestrategycenter.org. Come out, put it in your book, April 11th on a Thursday night. Come to South Central, where there's very few white working class people, but there's a lot of love for the working class and for immigrants. This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines.
I bleed a life that's full. I've traveled each and every highway and more, much more than this. I did it my way. Yes, regrets, I've had a few, but then again, too few to mention. I did what I had to do and saw it through without exemption. I planned each charted course, each careful footstep along the byway. Yeah, oh, much more than this, I did it my way. If there were times, I'm sure you knew, when I bit off much more than I could chew, I threw it all. I've laughed and cried, I've had my fill.